The Movements is a leftist history and politics podcast. Subscribe on iTunes, Stitcher, and Google Play. Find us on Facebook and Twitter at Movements Pod, and support the show by donating at patreon.com/movementspod. Ahoy, comrades. I'm almost done. I'm approaching the ending stages for the latest history episode, The Russian Revolution Part 4. I am hoping that should be up and live early July, maybe mid-July, somewhere around there. So today what we've got for you is a bit of a heavy topic conversation with Adam Patterson, our old friend who's coming back on the show. We're going to be talking about ethnic cleansing and genocide on today's episode. You know, it's going to be pretty heavy stuff. I feel like we talk about this stuff on other shows because history tends to have a lot of those two things. But today is really going to be focusing on the phenomenon of ethnic cleansing and genocide, the trends that lead up to an ethnic cleansing and genocide, and, you know, what those events in history tend to look like. Yeah, so this might be kind of a rough one, but I promise at the end of the episode, we're going to do something silly, completely unrelated to ethnic cleansing and genocide, which I swear to God, I've said that phrase about 10 times so far in this episode already. Yeah, so without much ado, here's Adam. I'd like to welcome back to the show, Adam Patterson. If y'all been listening for the last couple of years, Adam's a regular guest on The Movements. He is the one who came up with the name Stalin for Time. I'm forever grateful to Adam Patterson. So thanks for coming back on the show.
Yeah, thanks, Kenny. It's great to be back. It's always a joy to be on the show and discuss easily the most lighthearted subject matter that ever comes on this podcast.
I know, right? We keep talking about how our episodes that we do together get progressively more depressing over time. And so I decided, seeing as news headlines in the United States recently have been looking more and more like the histories that we talk about and that I cover on the show, that who better to have to discuss ethnic cleansing and genocide than Adam? So would you mind just like briefly kind of giving the audience a reminder of your background?
Sure. Yeah. So I am a sort of a specialist in particularly cheerful subjects. My my studies and focus area encompass broadly the study of war and human conflict. My specialty sub-areas are sort of irregular warfare, guerrilla warfare, insurgent movements, and also terrorism, especially Salafi jihadi terrorism and extremist movements. And as an adjunct to that, I also have sort of dedicated considerable time to studying and writing on ethnic cleansing as well, and the history of genocide, which oftentimes sort of runs as an adjunct to human conflicts. Oftentimes you will see either precipitating or following warfare, you will see sort of, again, sort of moments of ethnic or internecine violence. And sort of that is, I guess, part of my rather cheerful portfolio, both personally and academically.
Oh, boy. Great. So, yeah. So I think I want to get us started off by just sort of very briefly discussing. So what we'll be talking about today, it's rough stuff. It's ethnic cleansing and genocide. Genocide, ethnic cleansing. So the tricky thing to talk about those is there are definitions that exist, but it's kind of hard to get universal agreement on exactly what these terms mean. The UN definition of genocide, which I think is probably the one that's the most cited, it's not exclusively about killing. It also includes things such as destroying a culture, separating, destroying families, things like that. A lot of things that would also meet the criteria for ethnic cleansing. So I guess to get our terms sort of like on the same page here, we're going to be talking about events that sort of, you know, they're not all the same, but they have some common similarities, ethnic cleansing and genocide. So I just want to get first things up to the front here. These events that we're going to be talking about, we're not saying they're all the exact same things. We're saying they have very similar and common themes and preludes that are really important to learn how to recognize. So got the disclaimer out of the way. So first things first, Adam wrote this really interesting blog post on his blog, napalminthemorning.com, titled Prelude to Atrocity. So in the news most recently, we've been seeing a lot of news stories about this increase in essentially concentration camps full of ICE detainees, undocumented immigrants mostly, which children have been separated from their family and caretakers in not just being separated, but also in ways in which it's most likely going to be extremely difficult to get these children and their parents reunited, if even that were to even be something that would happen, which the government as of right now is not really interested in putting a whole lot of effort into it. And you've had senators and other individuals try to get into these concentration camps with varying mixed levels of success and access. What we have been able to hear out of these concentration camps are really quite horrific in terms of just having tons of people in cramped spaces, just laying on the ground covered in like these tinfoil beds and such. It's worth noting that many of these conditions are not unique to the Trump administration. There's definitely been an escalation in the numbers of people in these sorts of detention centers, concentration camps, prisons. But certainly policy has gotten dramatically worse in recent weeks. So, Adam, I wanted to ask you about your article, your blog post, which paints a sort of a realistic scenario for the current concentration camps turning into de facto death camps. A lot of people object to comparisons to Nazi Germany or other genocidal political projects throughout history. And I think you make a convincing argument that you don't go from zero to final solution death camps immediately. It's a gradual process, and you've painted a pretty harrowing picture of what a near future situation could look like. Would you mind just sort of giving the audience a summary of what you wrote about?
Absolutely. And it's interesting you bring up, sort of as a preface to that, bring up the Holocaust, because that's typically the touchstone or sort of the point at which most Americans, that's the genocide they typically refer to. It's the historical atrocity that is most commonly known and recognized. I'd say that, and we can again discuss this a bit later, that might actually be a less analogous touchstone than certain other atrocities that have happened throughout the historical timeline for various reasons. But to sort of circle back to my article, the argument I'd made is that all the various warning signs for an escalation in brutality against a demonized and hated population are very much there. You see, for example, the rhetoric coming from the executive branch, the Trump White House stoking fears of MS-13, of Central American gang members, also some auxiliary fears of sort of narco cartels, implying very heavily that asylum seekers and Latin American migrants represent a looming threat and force of degeneration and social corruption and crime in the U.S., and implying that sort of Latin American migrants are a distinct threat to the sanctity of American society. You also will see a rather literal reference to asylum seekers or migrants as people who, quote unquote, infest the United States. Like, the language of demonization and dehumanization is a very pointed precursor, oftentimes to an escalation in atrocity or cruelty against a particular ethnic group. And it does take this simultaneous cast of both, on the one hand, dehumanizing them, comparing them to things that are an infestation, like, you know, cockroaches is what the Hutu genocidaires typically refer to the Tutsis as during a hate radio broadcasts. Nazi Germany went to just grotesque lengths to describe Jews as rats, pigs, maggots, cockroaches. Sort of the language of dehumanization and infestation, coupled with the declaration that these groups or a hated ethnic group also represents an existential threat to the dominant culture or dominant ethnic group of society, that they must be removed, that they are both subhuman and an imminent threat that is not merely present but growing. So that is very much in place. And also, there's sort of an auxiliary to this. There is a willing and active institutional law enforcement structure for rounding up these ethnic groups, and not merely for rounding them up, but is demonstrably abusive and cruel towards them, even at this stage. And I think it's relevant and important to bring up the fact that this had been sort of – there had been abuses towards sort of El Salvador and Guatemalan Mexican detainees at the hands of ICE, both during the Trump administration and beforehand as well, that there had been sort of a longstanding reports of sexual abuse against detainees, for example. There's been reports that activists or sort of humanitarians who try to leave out water or supplies along the transit routes or sort of back paths that migrants take to reach the U.S. from Mexico, the water left behind has been, you know, destroyed or sabotaged or taken by ICE agents. And we're seeing nowadays the process of destroying the family unit, deliberately wrenching. This is a sort of a very new and recent creation, distinct of the Trump administration, that shows an escalation in cruelty of wrenching families apart, destroying the sanctity of the family structure. There have been reports, for example, that children kept in sort of detainment centers specifically for juveniles have been shot up with psychotropic drugs to keep them docile or sort of under heel. And sort of you're seeing this not merely are groups of people, sort of, again, Central American asylum seekers and immigrants being described as subhuman. They are being treated actively as subhuman by what is a law and customs enforcement organization. And that's pretty bleak. We're also seeing that, of course, the conditions in some of these camps are already pretty execrable as is. People kept in sort of concentration in very small spaces in large numbers. The most particularly chilling of which was recording of a large group of children basically wailing and screaming for their parents, and ICE agents quite literally laughing at them, joking that all we need here is a conductor for this orchestra or something like that. And it's horrifying, and it shows sort of there's already a sort of systemic hatred and contempt for this, again, particularly demonized group of people coming from the law enforcement apparatus. And of course, it extends all the way up. As I mentioned, Trump has sort of repeatedly demonized them. And the situation I laid out was the bleakest and worst possible sort of end game, because all these alarm bells have been going off for me as sort of precursors to escalating cruelty. But the situation I laid out was, as absolute worst comes to worst, and I hope, you know, to every God you can imagine this doesn't happen, but Central American migrants are taken to detention centers where the neglect for them is endemic. They are kept in places where heat stroke. They're basically relocated or put in camps where there's a possibility of a heat stroke in the desert, exposure at night. They're underfed. They're not given enough water. And assuming things go to the absolute worst, we are looking down the line at a situation where instead of, like, for example, the active murder of Latin American migrants, they're simply kept in deeply inhumane and potentially lethal conditions and allowed to basically passively die due to, again, exposure to the elements, neglect, dehydration, etc. And that is the potentially absolute worst case scenario we're looking at, because people, to sort of wrap this up, people sort of look at, for example, the Holocaust, and sort of when people invoke the Holocaust when discussing the rhetoric and hatred and cruelty already leveraged towards sort of El Salvadorans, Guatemalans, and Mexicans in this country, they say, well, people aren't just, you know, building death camps. People aren't, you know, goose-stepping through the streets and, you know, using an exaggerated German accent. Like, this is a 1990s World War II film, you know. There's not, you know, discussion of, you know, procuring, you know, Zyklon B and things like that. And of course, the counter to that is, throughout history, ethnic cleansing and genocides rarely actually looked and were organized like the Holocaust. They oftentimes, from the Armenian genocide to the ethnic cleansing and genocide against the people of the North Caucasus in 1800s and early 1900s Russia, took the form of expelling them and oftentimes allowing them to be killed basically by the elements. And that is, again, to sort of wrap this all up, as the absolute most harrowing conclusion, potentially how sort of brutalities against Central American migrants, the form it can take.
Yeah, I wanted to. I'm glad you brought up the example of the Armenian genocide, as well as some of the in the Caucasus, which I actually know a lot less about these other ethnic cleansings. I think one of the things that I've been encountering a lot over the last couple of days is, and I think a lot of folks who aren't as interested in ethnic cleansing and genocide is weirdos like the two of us are. Folks have been shocked and appalled at the amount of denial that they are seeing in their families, even in a lot of cases, if not, you know, it's not just like the guy on Facebook that you went to high school with 20 years ago that you never talked to. In some cases, it's people close to you who are defending in denial of some of the things that are going on. Obviously, we are not yet at the, you know, level where, as you described, the scenario in which these concentration camps turn into sort of, you know, quiet extermination camps by virtue of like, oh, sorry, they died of exposure. That was a mistake rather than gas chambers. We're not yet at that level, but already we're seeing a lot of the signs of denial in terms of, you know, it's trying to change the subject, trying to point to little tiny minor details. For example, so obviously there are folks who are just straight up lying about the fact that, oh, this is a democratic legislation. We have to do this. That is a complete absurd lie. There's a really blatant form of denial. And then there's the lesser form of denial in which folks are just saying like, oh, well, you weren't saying anything about this when the Obama administration was doing, you know, detaining children, throwing them in crowded conditions, things like that, which is true. This is something that actually did occur. And in fact, many people, many radicals, many Latin folks, regardless of what their political affiliations are, have been complaining and demanding justice, often to very little care from the majority of Americans, for sure. But the way in which this is turned into a denial is they take something that is absolutely true and then frame it in a way that the logical conclusion is, well, you're just like picking on Trump. And that's where the focus is, taking it away from the atrocity that's being committed and redirecting it into something that's really not the point. So basically this is the way I want to compare this to is I think it's fascinating and horrifying, but fascinating, the similarities I've noticed to other forms of atrocity denial. I think the Turkish denial, it's something that is quite horrifying to hear a lot of the times, because oftentimes the arguments are things like, there was no policy of murdering Armenians. You know, it was a mistake. We didn't intend for that to happen. It just so happened a bunch of them happened to die of exposure or of disease or of not being given medical care. But it wasn't the intention. So don't call it a genocide. It's super wicked offensive. Or the fact that there were certain Armenian like political organizations that had support from the Russian Empire. So there was a legitimate security concern and that sort of thing. I'd be curious to hear what are your thoughts in terms of, you know, what are some of the common forms of atrocity and genocide denial that are common to a lot of the examples that you're familiar with? You know, how much of it do you see in terms of this current debate that's going on right now?
Yeah, that's a very good question. I think the Armenian example is highly relevant in a lot of ways. One of the funny ways, or one of the darker things at the same time, is how sort of atrocities are typically sold to the public is in positive terms. If you look at, for example, the language of both the Ottoman authorities and the Third Reich, the Third Reich, of course, framed the precursor of the genocide as actually strengthening, sort of a patriotic, heroic strengthening of the German heartland by removing a menacing or degenerate element within German society or within European society as a whole. And ultimately, the Ottomans sort of rendered it as a security threat. And of course, there had been a longstanding history of repression against the Armenians in the Ottoman Empire that they oftentimes rose up against, sometimes with arms, but violence. And so the sort of the Ottoman authorities described the Armenians as both a sort of hostile internal element, a menacing security threat, and also in league with sort of outside elements, in league with sort of the Russians, for example. And and therefore from there said that it was merely a both a unfortunate necessity, but also a duty to the sanctity of the Ottoman Empire to expel or simply remove hostile internal elements. Of course, we know sort of looking at documents, and even at the time, there were German authorities, ironically enough, in the Ottoman Empire who basically said that, yeah, we get the sense that very explicitly that both the Ottoman authorities and sort of local viziers are intending to basically genocide the Armenians wholesale from the Transcaucasus. This is not merely an ethnic cleansing. But the way in which it's sold is, again, in a very positive term or in the language of necessity. And it also, like, again, does mingle a little bit with a denialism, of course, as you mentioned, sort of denying that there is sort of active cruelty. And if you see from the sort of Trump administration, it's a combination of projection, denial, and rationalization. Of course, projection saying, oh, what we're doing here is merely not us. It is solely a result of pre-existing legislation, even though it's clear that both in terms of policy and action, the cruelty is ratcheted up under Trump. And of course, denial, sort of denying that it's happening at all. And also rationalization saying that, of course, this is a necessary process. This is something that must be done. It's merely for, again, protecting America from, you know, poisonous gang elements, MS-13, things like that. And what that sort of mechanism, precursor to any potential atrocity, small or big, typically ingrains a growing tolerance. It's sort of where the public becomes increasingly, or at least a bulk of the public becomes increasingly tolerant, if not accepting, of what is an escalation in brutality. And it happens slowly enough that it sort of moves towards a potential greater atrocity in a sort of slow fashion where the public does acclimate rather than sort of an abrupt outrage.
Yeah, I mean, it's very true because, you know, these sorts of phenomenon, they don't all look the same. They don't all necessarily have the same level of severity, but they do have a lot of these common themes. I remember... So to bring it back to the Armenian genocide example, the first time I was aware of the basic phenomenon, but I didn't grow up with a lot of Turks. When I would meet Turks, I wouldn't necessarily be like, oh, hey, you're from Turkey. Tell me about the Armenian genocide. Was it a genocide? Yeah. Not really the first thing I thought of, you know, the first thing I thought of was, can I bum that cigarette typically? But yeah. So, and I remember a number of years ago at a party with a bunch of folks from other countries working. I don't know where they were working for, but it was New York City. It was rich foreigners, like that sort of thing. Not the kind of foreigners I come from. The ones that had a lot more money. But anyway, and, you know, and we're having some drinks, you know, telling some stories, listening to some music, and then I hear a guy saying, talking about like, well, you know, what people don't understand is that they, you know, there was a war going on and there was a serious security threat and there was no policy of getting rid of murdering the Armenians. And like, you know, it's very terrible what happened, but like it is completely. And I'm sitting there, you know, having my drinky drink, just trying to have a good time. And I thought to myself, this motherfucker is denying the Armenian genocide. Holy shit. This is the first time. It was the first time I had ever heard it in actual real life before. And as he continued talking, what blew my mind was, holy shit, these sound so similar to when I have had conversations with Zionists denying the Nakba. Or trying to minimize or rationalize, I think like the more common trend now is not to fully deny that it happened. Like with the Turks, they'll admit that there were deaths. They'll, you know, and it was a terrible thing. But the common thread that they have is to acknowledge that there were some terrible things that happened, but then to claim it was not the intention, and that there was a legitimate security threat. And to come up with all these other excuses that at the end of the day rationalized an ethnic cleansing. Certainly with the Armenian genocide denial, the death count was much larger. But in the ethnic cleansing of Palestine, it was more expulsions. But there were dozens of massacres that did occur. And those people, none of them ever were called to account for it. Several of the people who were in positions of power during when many of these atrocities went on became prime ministers and other like major cabinet members in future governments for years to come. Mm-hmm. And it continues to this day. There are still people who on some level still continue to rationalize or minimize these things that happened. And it's horrifying for me when I am hearing these things from people I respect or care about. I mean, this is more coming. I think when I hear people defending ICE camps, I'm just like, go fuck yourself. You know, there's mm-hmm. no ambiguity there. I think for me, the part where it gets more difficult and where I like have to put myself in the shoes of the folks who do have family who are all of a sudden revealing how horrifying they are, is like myself, like when I am in shared Jewish spaces. And then you get like, you know, nowadays things are very different. People are starting to realize what really happened. And there's a major mm-hmm. change in public opinion amongst American Jews, at least. But you still every once in a while find yourself in a context where people say absolutely vile and terrible things about the Palestinians that amount to a form of denial. And it's incredibly mundane.
Yeah. Yeah, it's tough too, because the cognitive dissonance for any group of people who want to venerate or at least respect or feel comfortable in their nation when faced with atrocities is huge. Like the cognitive dissonance is immense and oftentimes overbearing, and therefore rather than deal with basically the potentially worldview shattering sort of internal strife that comes with recognizing that your nation, however defined, has committed atrocities, people will typically rationalize it, as you say, sort of put it, sort of try to render it in neutral or just almost like pseudo-tragic terms. Like, oh, it's just so unfortunate what happened, you know, quote-unquote mistakes were made, because no one wants to see themselves or their nation or their defined people as capable of committing atrocities, or the human animal as a whole. I mean, what's unfortunate is that across the human timeline, to quote the war nerd, a.k.a. Gary Brecher, genocide is the hidden norm of history. I mean, so many empires, so many dominant ethnic groups or states have committed acts of expulsion, ethnic cleansing, or genocide. And it's what's also kind of disconcerting is how resilient so many nation states are in absorbing atrocities. Like even in the United States, of course, this country was founded by the westward expansion and either expulsion or extermination of the native peoples. And of course, that was aided by possibly the most effective accidental biological weapon in history, which was, of course, just the flu and various European diseases that the native people were able to sort of their health defend against. But sort of beyond that, what's sort of surprising when you look at the historical record is that sort of these atrocities just sort of litter history, and then people just find a way to either shrug or move on or deny them or sort of forget they've happened at all, just simply for the purpose of putting them in the rear view. And that's what's sort of tough about it, is that you people forget just how common they are and sort of how so many of them, of course, don't take the form of the Holocaust, which was a mm-hmm. large-scale industrial organized murder. They take the form of, for example, the Armenian genocide and the Circassian and Chechen genocides, where the group in question was not in most cases killed by weaponry, were killed by guns. They were killed oftentimes by being driven into extreme weather conditions or environments like either cold winters or deserts, and often given deliberately withheld food or water. So in a way, oftentimes in terms of these genocides, people do have the ability to, in a very sick way, say, we didn't do this. It was unfortunately, it was the weather, or it was merely a drought, or it was, you know, an unfortunate side effect of moving a malcontent population. It's, of course, the what's also, as I said, typical of genocide is the passivity of the murder, that oftentimes it's not literally by human hands inflicting the death blow. It's by, again, exposure or dehydration and things like that.
In the examples that you're familiar with, what have been some of the attempts and the trends in resistance to these policies, whether through electoral, whether through the political system itself or by armed resistance or things along those lines? What would you say are some of the more interesting or successful or unsuccessful examples that you can think of?
So it's sort of a kind of a funny question, because in cases where genocide has been somehow averted, we don't hear about it because genocide was averted. But so there's not sort of it's sort of difficult to sort of bring up examples like that off the top of my head. But in terms of acts of resistance, there was a just particularly to the Armenian genocide, there was a uprising called the Van Resistance, where sort of Armenians sort of within a sort of hub of Ottoman Germany called the – or not Ottoman Germany. Hello, I'm mixing my genocides. Ottoman Turkey called the Van Vilayets basically rose up against the attempts of the Ottoman authorities to flush them out and basically drive them potentially sort of from their longstanding homeland. And what's sort of tragic in cases like this is typically when – and these typically occur again in cases of war or sort of longstanding conflict where the targeted people – will rise up and sort of in self-defense in sort of anticipation of a further genocide, and typically will use whatever arms they have available to either slow the advance or sort of prevent the authorities that are trying to persecute them from sort of escalating the murder. And what's difficult about this, and this is, of course, was kind of the case with the sort of the Armenian resistance at the sort of at Van, was that the morally and human justified resistance on the part of the Armenians against the Ottoman authorities who were attempting to cleanse them was used as evidence that the Armenians are just violent security threat that must be removed.
Of course.
And that's what's – yeah, of course. And that's what's tragic about it is oftentimes – you know, it's also even if we go to a much more modern example, the Anfal genocide against the Kurds in northern Iraq was – rationalized on the grounds, and of course the Kurds have historically had a reputation as very tough people, and of course in a way that's taken a tragic bent because the Kurds were also recruited as enforcers during the Armenian genocide because of their history as brigands and raiders made them easy to goad into basically being the sword arm of the Ottoman persecution of the Armenians. But in a sort of more positive, more modern iteration, the Kurds had for a long time put up a very tough resistance against Saddam Hussein's abilities to break their hopes for independence or self-governance in the north of Iraq, what is now known rightfully as the Kurdistan Regional Government, KRG. And, of course, the toughness of the Peshmerga against the Arab irregulars of Saddam's regime was seen as evidence that the Kurds were quite simply a menacing threat that must be dealt with, and that this therefore gave a sort of sick propagandistic credence to Saddam's rationalization for eventually dropping gas on the Kurds and also engaging in a policy of, in some areas, of quite explicitly rounding up combat age young men, Kurdish men, and just killing them. Just saying that we just, for the sake of the sort of sanctity of this regime and for the sake of our own security, we must basically eliminate the Kurdish resistance. We must kill all combat age Kurdish men. But we're doing this because, of course, they have been shown a history of violence and armed activity. And, of course, the reason the Kurds showed a violence and armed activity was as an act of resistance, not aggression. Mm-hmm. But, of course, as is the classic perverse pseudo-logic of genocidaires, acts of resistance are therefore spun as rationale for further violence against a targeted group. But I will say that in terms of resistances that were particularly admirable and even if momentarily showed sort of the will of a people to not break against an attempt to persecute them further, I'd say the siege of Van or the Van resistance in the Ottoman Empire at the hands of the Armenians is one, and the ongoing Kurdish resistance against Saddam Hussein as well.
Yeah, I think It's an interesting question, and you make a great point in terms of the successful resistances to genocide. We don't know about them because there was no genocide. Gosh, isn't that depressing to hear about in some ways? I guess there's something to be said about being able to resist even if you ultimately lose, or even the possibility that you might be able to make some small impact. And I think that's something that a lot of folks are reflecting on right now, in terms of, you know, we've seen the memes go around in terms of, oh, you know, all those times in, like, you know, high school, or while smoking some weed in college, and you were having some deep conversation with your friends when you were like, man, if, like, you know, they started building concentration camps, like, I would have totally, like, picked up a gun and fought against, you know, whatever. And it's like, well, actually, we're starting to get to that point. And, well, what practically is there to do? How do you respond to these situations? You know, obviously, I think it's impractical a lot of the times to say, like, we're going to raise a peasant army and, you know, release the ICE prisons. But obviously, I think there are other forms of resistance, given the current conditions, that can still be taken. For example, I've been very inspired by the local DSA chapter in D.C., that went into that Mexican restaurant, which, by the way, for real, they keep on eating at Mexican restaurants. You got to be kidding me. Going into the Mexican restaurant to shout at, God, I'm forgetting her name, Kirsten something or other, the head of ICE.
Kirsten Nielsen. She's DHS secretary, actually, not merely sort of the head of ICE.
Oh, right. Yeah, I forgot ICE is part of Homeland Security. We can thank Bush W. for that one. But, well, let's also praise Laura Bush for her op-ed, completely unawares of the fact that her husband helped to create ICE. And anyway, that's another story. In to harass her and shout her out of the restaurant, and folks, you know, blocking entrances to ICE buildings, things like that. I find it very courageous. Frankly, I find it effective. I think it's got a powerful morale boosting effect. It's got, you know, I'm not necessarily, like, into symbolic actions purely for the symbolism, but I do actually think it had a serious symbolic effect in terms of keeping this in the media, keeping, you know, inspiring people to really go at it when they're arguing with their family members, or, you know, the way that these things are discussed in the media. And then you read some Andrew Sullivan. I don't know if you saw Andrew Sullivan's latest piece.
God help me. That trash article. Yes.
You saw that? Yeah. Basically, I believe the headline was, in order to stop family separations, we need the wall. And it was essentially calling for compromise. Like, this, you know, it's classic centrism. Classic just centrism, capitulationism, if that's a term. I don't know if that exists. I'm coining it right now. It is a defining, in my opinion, a defining feature of centrist politics is, let's meet you halfway on genocide and ethnic cleansing. I can't believe the man is still a public intellectual. Like, dear God.
Neither could I. Like, Sullivan is just so bizarre. Like, you know, his obsessive need to defend and promote Charles, you know, break out the calipers, Murray, is ludicrous. Like, he will, and the thing is, like, it's a bugbear of his, it's an obsession. Like, he will regularly pop up to, like, defend and promote Charles Murray, and, like, gets really sensitive and touchy when people are like, no, a lot of what he wrote was pseudoscientific nonsense, and basically attempts to rationalize man-made hierarchies through sort of, again, racial pseudoscience. Like, come on. But I think it speaks a lot about him. It says a lot about him, uncomfortably so. You can sort of tell a lot about people by who they choose to most passionately defend. And it's not looking good, Sully. You know, it's his I'm kind of waiting for him to, you know, come out and start promoting 1800s phrenology any day now. But yeah, no. To sort of circle back to your questions of how do we resist, or sort of how do we push back against this, I'm agreeing with you that symbolic actions are no small thing, because I think if things are going to get worse and more cruel towards sort of Mexican, Guatemalans, El Salvadoran migrants, it's not going to be a noisy thing. It's going to happen quietly, and it'll happen deliberately under the radar. So basically keeping it in the news and showing in a very explicit and broad way that a huge amount of the American population just – or enough of the American population just does not accept this and does hold this to be atrocious, and not allowing it to borrow an overused phrase, not allowing it to be normalized.
Yeah,
just sort of make that very explicitly clear. And there's an adjunct to this as well. It's something that I've seen that I think is a very clever and smart form of activism is people I know who have been publishing and disclosing exactly which contractors and corporations are profiting off of and running these centers, and shaming them and encouraging divestment and encouraging their brand and name to be deservedly stained by the fact that they're running these facilities.
And yet, you know, you will find centrists and folks who will denounce things like publicly naming and shaming, will denounce. I was listening to NPR this morning, and they had a panel of folks, I believe it was on Point, and they had a panel of folks to talk about the current ICE concentration camp and policy and such. And several of these panelists, not callers, panelists, were talking about how they disagreed with the disruption tactics and were like, well, no, we still need to be able to listen to each other. And, you know, that is the touchstone of democracy, things that and the other thing. And I'm just like, this is what I'm like. So there's the obvious fear that like Trump, the worst case scenario, Trump, like, you know, we actually do descend into, you know, outright fascistic, you know, fascist state. And then there is the more mundane fear that I have, which is we have like another, maybe even two Trump terms, who knows? And the center gets pushed very far right. And then a Democrat is elected president. Maybe they win Congress. But then because of the change in the political landscape and the inability of the liberal left, of the bourgeois, you know, capitalist liberals to mount an effective resistance against fascism, that they continue this strategy of let's meet them halfway. I mean, that was what the whole Obama policy was about, was we need comprehensive immigration reform. We're going to come up with a deal. Meanwhile, I am going to massively upscale the raids and the deportations. It's been the Democratic Party and sort of the liberal left approach for quite some time now. And I don't know that I have very little reason to believe that once, you know, if the Democrats are able to take the White House in the next election or two, that they will be able to effectively push this back in a in like a serious, long term, meaningful way. That is my major fear, is that by the time we get there, we're just going to go back to at best what was already happening under Obama, and more likely something between Obama and Trump as their sort of form of compromise.
I think that's a very valid fear. And I think one of the difficulties in preventing that from happening is sort of finding a way to actually have a better, more humane immigration policy would require a more necessarily radical reckoning with how U.S. policy and actions have contributed to the displacement and migrant crisis in Central America, both in terms of sort of U.S. actions in El Salvador, sort of left sort of were responsible for, I think, seeding and promoting the conditions that led to the violent disarray the country has fallen into today, and also sort of on a more broader and even more difficult to reckon with basis is the culpability of both U.S. policy and, frankly, U.S. pharmaceutical corporations in inflaming the narco-insurgency in Mexico. For example, the particularly notorious one is Purdue Pharma, Purdue Pharmaceuticals, that both manufactured and promoted and branded OxyContin throughout the 90s as sort of a safe alternative to morphine and other painkillers, did so in a very cynical, knowing way, sort of with realizing in many ways that it was an addictive or at least unsafe product that led to a sort of vast expansion in the prescription of opioid pain pills that sort of seeded the Oxycontin and sort of Vicodin and Percocet and now various other branded medications that made up an addiction crisis. Those, of course, proved to be too expensive in certain cases, so that led to a demand for just raw heroin. Something that people don't talk about much is that the supply chain of contraband of heroin to the United States typically started with manufacturing in Afghanistan, maybe Thailand, and then going sort of through various port channels or through Mexico up into the U.S. border. That supply chain, because the demand for heroin in the United States has skyrocketed so sharply, Mexican cartels have taken to planting opium fields in Mexico itself. I believe Guerrero, Mexico, has become responsible for producing a lot of the raw opium and heroin. And what happened in the process, I mean, let me just see if I can pull up the article here. I wrote about this as well, actually, about 3 years ago. The cartel violence and turf wars that were unleashed in Guerrero, Mexico, in relatively recent years resulted in the displacement of, I think, like over 100,000 local citizens. Like many people who are fleeing into the U.S. are fleeing either gang or cartel violence that, as I mentioned, are either that were in many ways inflamed or in certain ways even unintentionally initiated by U.S. policy. And we're going to have to consider all sorts of things from, again, a more genuinely humane immigration policy and overhaul to how we handle that to also, frankly, looking at some forms of decriminalization of drugs and sort of changing the way in which our policies unintentionally fuel and empower cartel violence, which leads to human displacement, which leads to basically asylum seekers in the U.S. Like, we're going to have to look at this not in the merely sort of a subdued language of sort of small tweak reformism or compromise with the far right. We're going to have to overhaul this in a much more radical way if we at all want to make things anyway better.
And that seems – it seems like such a reasonable thing to ask for, and yet – this is even, you know, years before the current situation arose. Ever since I was a teenager and I first started, you know, to start learning about the history of where my family came from. For the audience that doesn't know, I'm first generation Guatemalan American, and my family came to the United States, most of them around the 80s-ish, early 90s, the ones who are here anyway. But yeah, so I think, you know, for years since I've started to understand the basic history, the Monroe Doctrine, 200 mm-hmm. plus years of U.S. domination and interference in Latin America specifically, is people are not interested in that.
No.
Whether you're talking the right winger or the centrist or the bourgeois liberal, you know, it's I, you know, there's, of course, individual folks who excel and actually are interested. They don't necessarily actually factor into the way they act out their politics, but they'll at least be sympathetic. Mm-hmm. They'll at least pretend.
Yeah.
But that's not even the majority of these folks. And to sort of take it to bring it to the analysis of the growing fascism in the United States, you have a lot of mm-hmm. people who are arguing like, you know, don't directly confront these people. Don't fight them in the streets. Dialogue is what we need. Mm-hmm. You know, things are getting more extreme and that's a problem. You know what? I used to be a fucking, you know, liberal. I was actually the most a centrist I ever was when I was in college. So, you know, anybody uh-huh. who says that college students are delusional liberals, they have no idea what they're talking about. It was not as an actual working class person who went to a 4-year college. That is bullshit. That is not it's not as easy, clear cut as that. I digress. Uh-huh. But, you know, I remember going through these experiences where I wanted to sort of have a dialogue. You know, when we'd have like a May Day protest, I'd be the guy who would go and speak with the counter protesters to try to, like, mm-hmm. my thought process was like, yo, if these things really go south someday and we end up having like a serious like fascist threat in this country, I had this thought that, you know, this guy who potentially in 10 or 15 years could potentially join some sort of death squad or, you know, some sort of fascist organization or something like that, maybe he'll remember this conversation. and like have a moment of humanity. You know, I would have these conversations and I would go up to these guys and I would say like, hey, let's have a real compromise. You know, I would, for the sake of argument, I would come up to them and I would say like, how about this? We will build a wall between the United States and Mexico. And we will, you know, start aggressively enforcing the border, this, that, and the other thing. And in exchange for that, all military and intelligence personnel, American and Latin America, need to leave immediately and without condition. And also, the price of your bananas is going to go up, and your other produce, your locally, you know, picked strawberries and stuff like that. And you stay the hell out of Latin America now and forever. And these people would be like, oh, yeah, sure. Yeah, we'll do that. You know, this, that, and the other thing. But I have no reason to believe any of them actually cared at all. Because they would move on immediately. Sorry. There was no genuine interest.
Yeah. I mean, sorry not to like cut off what is like a really like important and necessary sort of point and story you brought up. But this is what I was going to say in terms of sort of the concern that maybe if he, you know, had this guy had a civil and reasonable conversation with an actual Guatemalan, you know, a few years down the line, if he's in a death squad, he might, you know, look back on that. Sort of what always crosses my mind is that they're called death squads for a reason.
Yeah.
And that ethnic hatreds are both a very atavistic and tribalistic thing that are reinforced among a singular ethnic group. It's the sort of thing where they don't sort of follow along reasonable or rational lines. That's why if you want to stoke, as we discussed at the very sort of start of this episode, stoke hatred against a demonized sort of minority or disempowered ethnic group, you cast them as something to be feared and hated, that they are both vermin-like, or they're rats or cockroaches, or in tandem with that, they're a threat. And sort of you play to people's most paranoid, tribalistic instincts, sort of more firmly ingrained the sense that you are A, a superior people deserving protection, and that B, this other group are outsiders. They can never integrate or be a part of your society. They will always infest it. They will always, quote unquote, breed crime or breed degeneracy and sort of go from there. And that's what's so tough is that when atrocities truly start to gain steam, it's not a rational thing for a lot of people. It is merely sort of the inflaming of the darkest tendencies of the human animal towards tribalism and internecine violence.
Well,
I think
we should probably start to wrap this up. Did you have we will be doing a thing at the end of this discussion, but any last thoughts on genocide and ethnic cleansing?
Just a small thing to bring up sort of in terms of sort of Christian Nielsen and people being sort of outraged at the incivility of protesters yelling shame at her in a Mexican restaurant. Maybe this is too far, but the implicit message I guess you get from that is that basically the people who are complaining against that value civility towards this one sort of government figurehead more than they do the lives and sanctity of people living under ICE detention.
I think that is absolutely valid. And I think everybody who's listening to this right now, that when you hear other folks in your life make similar arguments, it still applies. And we need to seriously, seriously think about what the repercussions of that are, that there is a significant large minority of this country that would go along with the genocide.
Mm-hmm. And that's disconcerting. And I was going to say, it's not particular to the U.S. There are always, of course, there is in many societies, the potential of the genocide air next door. Given the right conditions, there are enough people who might in any time or place, you know, sort of move towards that if given the chance. And sort of something else, just again, before we wrap this up, I want to bring up is that to any of your listeners who aren't familiar with the subject, I strongly recommend reading about the history of Latin America, sort of the especially the specifics of both the U.S. intervention in the region, but also the relation between the governments of Central America and the U.S. and also do your research just for your own just enlightenment politically, and sort of make you a sort of a more well-rounded observer of history in the world. Do what you can, as I endeavor to do, and as I think a lot of people who are learning more and more about this, learn about the specifics of the U.S. drug war and the toll it has taken on Mexican society, and sort of the impact that U.S. policy in terms of the drug war has had on that as well. That's sort of, I think, something that's really important. And as someone who does sort of broadly study security issues, is something that even in my old field, in my own field, is not considered as sexy as, like, for example, U.S.-China tensions or the Middle East. But I think it's still just deeply, deeply relevant and important.
It is a harrowing, harrowing history that a lot of Americans know very, very little about. And I'll just end on this note that if you read up on the history of Latin America, of Guatemalans, Salvadorians, other folks as well, it will be shocking at how moderate and calm the response has been, and that Latin people don't want to destroy America. And that's actually pretty remarkable and unusual how little of, like, vicious hatred. I mean, anti-Americanism is absolutely a thing in Latin America, but it is, you know, you don't really see, you know, freaking Guatemalan suicide bombers. And that's not to, like, say anything against other forms of resistance, but it is something to be said of, good Lord, our patience is unreal.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, on that militant ass note, since this is some heavy stuff we've been talking about, I wanted to do something really silly. Adam, do you have your script ready with
I
you?
Do.
All right. We are going to be doing a scene from The Crucible by Arthur Miller. I will be reading for the part of Goody Proctor. Adam will be reading the part of, I actually don't remember who else is in this play. Let's just do the script, okay?
Yeah, I will actually be reading for the part of the witchcraft itself.
Of witchcraft.
Yeah.
Okay. I'm communism. Okay. All right.
Sweet.
Well, Seymour, I made it, despite your directions.
Ah, Superintendent Chalmers, welcome. I hope you're prepared for an unforgettable luncheon.
Yeah.
Oh, my God, it's my roast is ruined. What if I were to purchase fast food and disguise it as my own cooking? Oh, delightfully devilish, Seymour.
Skinner, with his crazy explanations, the superintendent's gonna need his medication. When he hears Skinner's lame exaggerations, there'll be trouble in town tonight. Seymour!
Superintendent, I was just stretching my calves on the windowsill. Isometric exercise, care to join me?
Why is there smoke coming out of your oven, Seymour?
Oh, no, this isn't smoke, it's steam. Steam from the steamed clams we're having. Mmm. Steam clams. Ugh. Superintendent, I hope you're ready for mouth-watering hamburgers.
I thought we were having steamed clams.
Oh, no. I said steamed hams. That's what I call hamburgers.
You call hamburgers steamed hams?
Yes, it's a regional dialect.
Uh-huh. What region?
Upstate New York?
Really? Well, I'm from Utica, and I've never heard anyone use the phrase steamed hams.
Oh, nah, not in Utica. No, it's an Albany expression.
I see. You know, these hamburgers are quite similar to the ones they have at Krusty Burger.
Oh, no. Patented Skinner Burgers, old family recipe.
For steamed hams.
Yes.
Yeah, so you call them steamed hams despite the fact they are obviously grilled.
Yeah, hey, you know, the one thing I should have... Excuse me for one second.
Of course.
Oh, well, that was wonderful. A good time was had by all. I'm pooped.
Yes, well, I should be... Good Lord, what is happening in there?
Aurora Borealis?
Aurora Borealis. at this time of year, at this time of day, in this part of the country, localized entirely within your kitchen?
Yes.
May I see it?
No.
Seymour, the house is on fire.
No, Mother, it's just the Northern Lights.
Well, Seymour, you are an odd fellow, but I must say, you steam a good ham.
Help! Help!
Okay, end scene.
End scene. I was going to say, like, this is what happens when you get two former theater kids, you know, to try to have a palate cleanser after discussing some of the heaviest subject matter in human history. This felt kind of like, you know, when you're trying out for an audition and you're just kind of reading a script and doing your best voice of what you think the character should sound like.
Yeah. I mean, we didn't rehearse this at all. I just was like trying to think of like, oh God, we're talking about genocide. We should do something that's just completely unrelated. You actually had never seen the full bit before.
No, it's funny. I was, of course, for some sort of culturally deprived reason, never really watched The Simpsons much when I was younger, even though I was kind of the right age. So I did not see the sort of Seymour Skinner steamed hams bit until an hour, not even, before we recorded this. And I've seen it like obliquely referenced and like in memes and remixed as various memes. I never actually seen the original product. And so here we are.
Yeah. If any audience listeners don't know what the hell we just did. One, do you use the internet? And two, 22 short films about Springfield. Amazing episode of The Simpsons. It's a classic. Look it up. Adam, where can folks find your writing and ideas and thoughts?
So if you want to sort of keep up with my writing, my blog is, as you mentioned, www.napalminthemorning.com. That's one word, and it's pulled from the Apocalypse Now quote. I've also written before for Current Affairs. That's www.currentaffairs.org, which is an excellent magazine that you should read and subscribe to. They do some of the best writing on contemporary politics in America today. And in the world. So check that out as well. Both, again, my writing there to self-promote, but most importantly, the magazine itself, which deserves as big a readership as it can get.
All right. Thank you so much for coming on Stalin for Time.
It was great, Kenny.
The Movements is a leftist history and politics podcast. Subscribe on iTunes, Stitcher, and Google Play. Find us on Facebook and Twitter at Movements Pod, and support the show by donating at patreon.com/movementspod.
Que vengan los policías a escuchar esta canción.